Good morning. Welcome to Back Chat. I'm Hugh Chiverton, your co-host today, Michael Chagani. Michael, good morning to you.
Morning, Hugh.
We're talking today about the Panama Papers, the massive leak of details from a law firm based in Panama that specialise in setting up offshore companies. More than 240,000 were revealed. They're linked to many political leaders around the world, as well as the richest individuals. Time magazine has called this recently a crisis of capitalism, as the 99% begin to learn how the rules that apply to them are evaded by the richest 1%. Political leaders from Putin to Pakistan, David Cameron's father and the family of Xi Jinping have been implicated. The Prime Minister of Iceland has already resigned. And Hong Kong has been playing a major role in this murky world. HSBC was among the most active in registering shell companies that move money around the world on behalf of the rich and politically connected clients. And Hong Kong topped the list of countries where intermediaries like banks, law firms, accountants and related firms operate, with over 2,200 listed. What does this signify? Is it a surprise? What do you think will be the impact on the offshore industry? Should Hong Kong be ashamed? Email us with your thoughts, questions and comments. Our address, backchat@rthk.hk. You can go to our Facebook page, Backchat and RTHK Radio 3, and comment there, or call us, 233 88266. After 9:20, we're talking about 10 years winning the Hong Kong Best Film Award with, among others, the executive producer. Joining us for our conversation, our first topic, we have with us David Webb, who's a shareholder activist, founder of website.com, David Dodwell, a public policy consultant and CEO of Strategic Access, and Judith Clark, associate professor in the Department of Journalism at the Baptist University. Good morning to you all.
Morning.
Good morning.
David Webb, we'll start maybe with you. Thanks very much indeed for joining us today. What do you make of this?
It's interesting. It's going to hopefully shed some light on some of the darker corners of government.
Is this really a dark corner, or did you know all about this anyway?
There's nothing wrong per se with having an offshore company. Let's get that straight. There are numerous legitimate reasons for setting them up. But one thing that I don't like about them is the lack of transparency when you try to research or investigate companies.
Which is the whole point of having these shell companies.
It's a point. And I think that point should be abolished, basically. The idea of selling secrecy as a product ought to be out of the window, following the various tightenings that have been going on in the banking sector. The same thing should be happening in the corporate registration sector. But there are other reasons for having companies offshore. For example, to legally avoid stamp duties in Hong Kong. If you want to hold a property through a BVI vehicle, you do have to pay stamp duty when the company buys the property. But after that, if you sell the company, then there'll be no stamp duty payable on that. So for that reason, I hold my flat through a Seychelles company. I paid the stamp duty when I bought the flat at the full rate, and if I want to sell the company in future, I can. And if you look at the Hong Kong-listed companies in Hong Kong, we have about 1,800 of them now. 47% of them are incorporated in the Cayman Islands, and 28% are incorporated in Bermuda. That makes 75% of all listed companies are incorporated in these two havens. Only 11%.
75% of all listed companies in Hong Kong are registered in the Caribbean.
In these two British colonies, basically.
You're talking about Hong Kong-listed companies, right?
Yes.
So if they're listed, 75%, that's a very large number. If they're listed overseas and it's not illegal, it's not
evading, they have good reasons for doing
it. But it's avoiding tax, but that's like...
They're actually planning ahead, Michael, because... There's nothing wrong, again, with avoiding tax. If you want to pass legislation to introduce new taxes or close loopholes, then by all means. And of course, if people are stupid enough to leave loopholes in their legislation, then they should be closed.
Do you think that those loopholes will be closed now? Obama said they should be.
If I can explain, the reason why a lot of companies, starting in 1984 with Jardine Matheson, moved from Hong Kong to Bermuda, and incorporated new holding companies over there, was the risk that one day Hong Kong's government would change its policy and start taxing global earnings of companies rather than the profits earned in Hong Kong. And they took a view that they would be happy to pay their profits tax in Hong Kong, on all their business in Hong Kong. And of course, most of their business, Jardine Group's business, was in Hong Kong. But why should they pay Hong Kong tax on Indonesian profits, which have already been taxed, or Hong Kong tax on other countries' profits? So it makes sense to use holding vehicles zero tax jurisdictions like Bermuda, and then to have subsidiaries which pay taxes in each country in which you do business. Now, where the loopholes have come is when you look at things in the UK like Google and Amazon and Starbucks and so on, which have come under attack for exploiting loopholes in the law there. To shift their profits to low tax or zero tax jurisdictions, low tax being Ireland, for example, and they are now going. The European Union has now come to an agreement, I think, to eliminate that tax loophole. There are nevertheless concerns about the secrecy thing, and as I said, I think that should be abolished. I want to be able to know who owns a BVI company when it is doing a transaction with a Hong Kong-listed company. And the stock exchange here, never mind what the BVI does, the stock exchange here could change its listing rules and require that when a listed company buys a business or an asset from a BVI shell, they have to say who's behind it. And they don't. And why don't they do that? It's because they're afraid of what they might see behind it, which is corrupt mainland officials or people connected to the listed company buying and selling assets on the cheap, either overpricing sales to the company or underpricing purchases from the company. And they'd rather have a sort of don't ask, don't tell policy and say, oh, well, because the BVI doesn't require that disclosure, we're not going to either. So the Hong Kong listing rules do incentivize people to use these shells in order to hide the ownership of
well,
of
okay.
The assets.
And the other point is, of course, that it's the people, it's the rich and powerful who make these rules that they can so easily evade and so efficiently evade, and that no one's chasing after these accounts and no one is seeking to put pressure on these people.
Well,
everyone's too busy hunting down hawkers in
Hong Kong,
the streets of Hong Kong. And there's
legislators who make laws.
The impression people have that there's 10 times as much effort put into that as there is seeking down the billions. Billions which are floating around in dodgy offshore accounts.
One thing that the Hong Kong government could do is to tear down the paywall on its registries, the company's registry and the lands registry. You have to pay per view for every document that you want at the moment. And that really inhibits research, investigative journalism and so on. Whereas the UK has last year abolished the paywall, and you can now get company documents going back 15 years or so electronically. They followed in the footsteps of New Zealand. So those two places now have full transparency over company filings. Anything that has to be filed with them can be seen by the public. Hong Kong Companies Registry makes a stonking great profit on its filing fees and would continue to do so even if it charged nothing for search fees. So it's not a question of sustainability of the registry. It's a monopoly that's out of control, frankly. It makes fun.
Okay, David Dodville, what, if anything, should be done about this? We've got the Panama Papers. They've come out. David Webb's explained that there's a lack of transparency. The rich are stashing money away, as Hugh pointed out. What should we do about it, if anything?
Well, a lot is being done. As far as I'm aware, there are post-2008, as regulation over the world's banking institutions has been tightened. So there has been immensely more energy put into know your customer arrangements make it increasingly hard for people using shells of this kind to use those shells for transactions, as David correctly suggests. So there are quite extensive efforts in place at the moment. One of the problems that I am aware of in the banking sector, and I know Hong Kong Bank are concerned about this, is that there at the moment is no basis on which they're allowed to share information about suspect accounts or suspect channels of funds with other banking institutions. They want rules to be put in place that allow them to inform another bank that money coming to them being transferred from their institution because they've shut somebody down is actually a suspect source of money. But I think, I know it's very exciting and interesting to, it's rather like the Edward Snowden files to to discover something as prolific, such a prodigious source of information that normally we wouldn't see. It is exciting, but it's important to remember that Hong Kong stands out in this in large part because of 1997, where many companies, it wasn't just Jardine Fleming, many companies and many individuals with family trusts and so on were quite legitimately concerned about what was going to happen in Hong Kong after 1997.
Yeah, but it's also the services we're providing. As I mentioned, Hong Kong is a centre. It has the largest number of intermediaries. It's the banks and accountants that are working for people around the world. It's not just the dodgy companies in Hong Kong.
They're not dodgy companies, Hugh. We're talking about people who, running up to 1997, were quite legitimately concerned about their future. And many of them fled.
I'm not talking about Hong Kong companies. I'm saying that we are like the lawyers for the mafia. We are providing services for these.
And it's maybe an important source of employment here.
No. I'm sure they're quite quite honest restaurant runners and things like that. But we're providing those services. It's our role as an intermediary, which is the worrying thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's important to allow legitimate financial services though, and legal services, and to help people set up their businesses. Should be a more friendly centre for establishing headquarters.
But David, Hugh had pointed out, we're the lawyers for the mafia. But when I saw this, and when I know the HSBC's involvement in all of this, and then just now when I came to the studio, I walked past the next studio, and Joshua Wong happens to be there now, talking about him being denied an account at HSBC. So why, ordinary guy is going to say to himself or herself, this little kid comes along, wants to start up a little political party, and he's denied a bank account, and then the HSBC is helping all these shell companies.
Or a company registration.
So isn't there a moral question there somewhere?
Yes. It's a separate issue, but I think Joshua Wong should be entitled to open his bank account. I think that the amount of interference of governments in the freedom of banks to do business with their clients has gone too far. Hundreds of millions of dollars are spent by each bank, billions, tens of billions globally, on what so-called AML, anti-money laundering obligations, where they have to know their clients and basically give them the Spanish Inquisition on where they got their money from before they can open an account. Particularly if they're on any list, and there is one very popular list of so-called PEPs, politically exposed persons, which you can fall into fairly easily just by sitting on a statutory board or something like that. And then you find it's very difficult to open a bank account without huge amounts of interrogation. And you start to wonder why new ideas like Bitcoin are becoming popular, because they could potentially bypass that. But, we need to make the banking system available again to the people that it's supposed to serve.
So on the one hand, they want to know where your money came from, and on the other hand, they'll help other people hide their money.
The point is that...
doesn't make sense to me.
I don't think that we should try to privatize social obligations and try to make banks policemen. It's all of this tens of billions of dollars around the world spent each year on AML is eventually paid for by customers, all of us, that cost I don't think has produced the benefits that offset it. Have we actually stopped people growing poppies in Afghanistan producing heroin, or coca plants in Bolivia to produce cocaine? Have we really stopped any terrorism by checking everybody who, like Joshua Wong, who tries to open a bank account, and slowing down people's ordinary daily life? I don't think that's been a fruitful approach, and the government ought to rethink that. We can't do it on our own, of course, because otherwise we're ostracized by the global financial community. So it has to be done by international agreement.
All right, Professor Clark, good morning to you.
Thank you
for joining us this morning. What's your take on this? And I mean, there's the journalism, because the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists who are kind of at the heart of this. So somebody got it's an anonymous source who got this information. They contacted a German newspaper, Süddeutsche Zeitung, and then they worked with the ICIJ, so it's kind of spread the responsibility as well. What do you make of the role of investigative journalists?
It's very interesting. I think we're seeing the coming of age of the new journalism, if you like. The journalism has faced a lot of problems in the last 20 years due to digital media, the internet, the breakdown of the old model of advertising-funded media. And advertising's beginning to regroup, but it's still not funding most media. And we've got these investigative outlets now that are being funded by philanthropists. ICIJ and its parent organization, CPI, are funded by many foundations, we just call them charities probably, in the US, a large number of them, and individuals. So they're not reliant on commerce, they're not reliant on governments, they're supposedly independent. So they can carry out this kind of journalism, and it's growing. We saw more than 10 years ago the widow of McDonald's founder, Ray Kroc, leave $200 million-plus to NPR, National Public Radio, in the U.S. to keep it going, and it's done wonderful things since. And we've seen also a number of these exposés, if you like, from Edward Snowden, Bradley Manning, and Offshore Secrets, which was done also on the Caribbean outlets. But I think this is really the biggest. This has really come together. I think the key has been two things. One is collaborative journalism. This Süddeutsche Zeitung had much too much data to process by itself, which has happened in the last few leaks. They need more people, so they spread it around the world and let journalists in each country examine the information on their country and process it. And secondly, on secure communication, because we've seen Edward Snowden exiled, Chelsea Manning jailed, and the HSBC leaker sentenced to 5 years in jail. He hasn't been jailed yet. And this time the whistleblower has been protected. We don't know who it is. I suspect that Mossack Fonseca know who it is, but they're not going to be talking too much about that. So I think it's a big achievement for the new form of journalism, collaborative, secure communication journalism.
Is it good for journalism as a whole, for the media as a whole?
Yeah,
that this happens?
I don't know whether you could compare it to Watergate as a kind of...
Watergate was just one newspaper, a couple of newspapers doing it.
Yeah, but it was huge, right? It was huge. And this probably won't unseat Obama. It's not the right time for that. But it has already unseated one prime minister. And so it is very, very big. And whether these things are legal or not, certainly they are unethical. And a lot of people don't know about them. They're secret. So I think it's very important that people should know about this. And what they've handled this time very well is the publication of the information. In the past, it's been restricted to a few newspapers. This time, they've done a big splash. It's taken them a year to process the information. And now suddenly it's come out all at once, and it's really hit the headlines.
Well, it hasn't, actually. The full data set is going to be held back until May. So
yeah.
Those papers who had the first bite, I don't know if they are donors to the ICIJ or what, but... They get to write stories for a few more weeks.
Yeah.
Fair enough if they're paying.
They're partners. I don't know if they're paying. I'm not sure.
It's The Guardian. There was a Panorama program which clearly was put together over a number of weeks. There's a number of different outlets have worked on it. If their organizations have contributed to ICIJ, I think that's great.
Are they safer as well because they can sort of got collective responsibility that, you know...
Safety in numbers.
Because if it's sensitive in one country...
370 journalists involved?
Unless it's China, you block it completely. In most places, it's going to leak out from somewhere else.
Yes. People are going to see it on the internet.
Well, the mainland China's reaction to the Xi Jinping connection in all of this was we're not going to comment on nonsense or whatever the word was that they used. But now that this has come out, and as you said, it's already taken a toll on one world leader from Iceland. As this thing progresses, how is that going to change? Since this is so massive, how is that going to change the financial world, how it works, how it's functions, how it registers companies, how its wealth is distributed.
Well, I think it could lead to pressure on these havens to drop their secrecy product and start competing on service quality and the service itself. So, you know, the BVI Companies Registry, which has over a million companies now, I think, is still not online. the only way to get any small amount of information, the articles of association of a company, but not its director list, is to pay an agent in the BVI who's legally registered to
obtain it. But if it drops the secrecy thing, so it loses its appeal, doesn't it?
No, because you can still compete on the fees that you charge every year for registration. You can compete on the company law requirements, whether, for example, you require a company to have audited accounts. Because a lot of companies only have one shareholder, which is another company. There's no outside shareholders to protect with auditing the financial statements. And one of the things that Hong Kong should look at is dropping the requirement for audited accounts for single-owner companies to make us more competitive against the BVI. I have a BVI company that employs my assistant, partly because it doesn't need to have an audit in the BVI, and therefore I save audit costs in Hong Kong. It's my company. It has no outside creditors or shareholders. Why would I want to pay a few thousand or $10,000 a year to an auditor for something I don't need? It's a gravy train that ought to be stopped. So we should... shareholders can unanimously opt not to have an audit.
The way to address that, surely, is not for you to evade. I understand why you do it.
No, I'm saying so.
But in Hong Kong, the way to evade that is to remove that requirement.
We could remove the requirement in Hong Kong. So meanwhile, people like the BVI can compete.
But you get your own
service.
House in order, yeah. And you don't. So you stop the attraction of these other.
Well, they would still compete on fees. I mean, the fees that it costs to set up a small business in Hong Kong.
But if you see that
are too high still.
If you see that the secrecy and so on is a downside, then you just say you're not allowed to do that anymore.
The secrecy should go. I think the company registry.
If you're working in Hong Kong and your main sort of income is to Hong Kong, you register in Hong Kong. You're a Hong Kong company.
You don't, but we can't prohibit overseas companies from doing business here. We're an international trade center. If they want to establish a branch here, then they can.
How can you say that you're an international company if you've got an overseas a tax haven company registered there and it's for your employee? You're clearly not an international company.
No. I'm fully registered as a business. It registers. It's subject to profits tax makes a profit. It doesn't, of course, because website doesn't have revenues and basically runs at a big loss every year, and I pay for it. But... the point is that we I can afford to do that, thankfully, as a public service. But the point is that we should allow jurisdictions to compete on service quality. If you can incorporate faster or more cheaply or have lower annual costs, then so be it. And that would force people like Hong Kong to rethink, why do we charge business registration fees every year when you haven't even turned a single dime of revenue? Why don't we just tax the profits? CY Leung in his policy address and John Chang in the budget said we need to pursue fair-minded principles about cost recovery. In that case, we shouldn't be charging the $2,000 business registration fee. That's not recovering any costs.
David Darville, should we do that? I mean, should we say, okay, let's make it a lot easier in Hong Kong? As Hugh pointed out, you put your own house in order, then you won't have these other problems.
No, for sure. I mean, let me give you another example. I worked most of my career with the Financial Times. I have a Financial Times pension. When I reached retirement age, I was given two choices. One was to receive my pension from the Financial Times and have it taxed at 40% in the UK before it was remitted to me, or I could uplift the pension and create a foreign trust and put the funds in the trust and manage the money myself. So I created a trust. It isn't a BVI trust or a Cayman's trust. It's actually here in Hong Kong, but it's nevertheless a trust. And I've taken my lifetime savings, my pension, away from the UK because it chooses to try to tax me on stuff that I've already been taxed. I don't feel in principle that's a legitimate practice on their part. The reality is that each economy around the world has different tax and regulatory arrangements, many of which don't make sense and many of which are onerous. And if you are lucky enough to have the power to escape some of those onerous obligations, then I don't think it's illegal to seek to do so. What we're talking about here, perhaps, is the need to separate what are perfectly legitimate reasons for managing what you've managed to save, from the illicit, illegal
corruption, for example.
This is the point. I mean, you say
hiding corrupt gains.
You say if you're lucky enough, but it's not a question of being lucky enough, or you know. It's not a question of luck, is it?
Well, I mean, a pension is hardly an exotic mountain of money. I'm not in the 1%, and so we're not necessarily talking about 1% at all. As I mentioned earlier, many Hong Kong families, perfectly ordinary families, created trusts in the BVI, Caymans, Bermuda, and so on, pre-1997. Even if they were of modest resources, because they were not certain about what the future would be. So there are many people, this is not a 1% matter, who have legitimate reasons and have acted to secure their whatever they've managed to save in their lifetimes. And we shouldn't be interfering to stop that perfectly legitimate activity from occurring. We want to get rid of the corrupt activity. And as David said, the lack of transparency that's allowed by the arrangements we're talking about here is at the heart of a very big problem.
Okay. Well, we're talking about the Panama Papers. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Drop us a line. Backchat@rthk.hk is our email address, or you can call us 233-882-66. You might want to do it over the next 3 minutes as we break for the news at 9 o'clock. Later, we're also going to be talking about 10 Years, the film that so now won the Hong Kong Best Film Award. We'll be talking to the executive producer and an industry specialist on that. And that's coming up later after the news at 9. The weather forecast for today now, it's going to be mainly cloudy, foggy this morning and at night. The sunny periods forecast during the day with a maximum temperature of about 27 degrees. Moderate east southeasterly winds, and the outlook is going to be warm and humid with some sunny periods forecast over the next couple of days and a few showers happening towards the weekend. Let's look at the latest information. The readings now at the observatory. The air temperature is at 22 Celsius and the relative humidity is now standing at 94%. Back in 3 minutes after the news. Welcome back. This is Bank Chat on a Wednesday morning with Michael Cigani and me, Hugh Tiverton. We continue to talk about the Panama Papers and the fallout. We have with us Judith Clark, Associate Professor in the Department of Journalism at the Hong Kong Baptist University, David Dodwell, a public policy consultant, CEO of Strategic Access, and David Webb, a shareholder activist, founder of website.com. Later, we're also going to be talking about the movie 10 Years, a recent winner of the Hong Kong Best Film Award. We'll be talking to the executive producer and an industry specialist on that. If you've got thoughts, please share them. backchat@rthk.hk is our email address. You can call us as well, 233-88266, and you can go to our Facebook page, which is Backchat and RTHK Radio 3, and share your thoughts there with the world. For example, there, Rod says, taxation is theft, so these activities are moral. What is immoral is the doublespeak of politicians taxing the populace while hiding their money. And Roz says, side note, will Backchat have a one-sided panel again this morning? Okay, Rod. Well, if you think that Backchat has a one-sided panel, then please just call us up or email us and even things out if you ever think that occurs. We do try our best to make sure all sides are represented. An interesting comment from Henry, which some other people have touched on as well. Henry says on our Facebook page, it seems strange that no US companies or people are involved in the papers leaked out. Given the role US plays in international finance, I just could not believe this. Could this be some deliberate move, says Henry. David Dodwell, is that because America is tighter generally on these things than other places, and their taxation, as Michael knows to his cost, their international taxation system is pretty.
I might pass the ball brutal. On that because it's a good question, and I asked.
Well,
it
Henry's wrong actually. There was at least one American involved already. Mm-hmm. She is a lady who
wrote
a self-help book.
But for scale, if you look at the finance industry, Hong Kong is. You look at the key players are Switzerland. And Hong Kong in this part of the world, and in
Singapore?
The Americas, it's
a lot tougher, Hugh. It's a lot tougher. Other than the fact that I'm taxed, even though I'm I'm living here. I pay tax in Hong Kong and in the U.S. In addition to that, every June the 30th, you have to file a form online that lists out exactly every bank account you've got, where it is, the bank number, account number, the address.
Everywhere
of the bank,
in the world.
Everywhere in the world. If you're living overseas, if you're not living in, if you're living abroad, not in the States, you have to do this, and it also asks you what the amount of money is in the bank, not what it is at the time you file, but its highest value during the year. And if you've got a high value, let's say you've got $1 million in one account, and then you've moved that $1 million into another account, then you're reporting two $1 million
double accounts. Counting, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, they keep a really close track on you.
Can I come in there? Yeah, I think what's been said is it's actually much easier just to have a shell company in the U.S. than it is in many other places, particularly in Delaware. And there's a lot more to be found out about the U.S. that isn't. Okay.
Oh, yes. If we go for... this is perhaps why the U.S. and other places have not been pushing for global transparency on company registers, because they're just as guilty of it themselves. If you try to investigate the ownership of a Delaware LLC or a Nevada LLC, there are 50 states in America, each with their own company registration rules, each with their own registries, and it's very hard in many places to find out who the directors are, who the shareholders are of these companies.
So it's just because... Because they wouldn't go through Mossack Fonseca.
They have secrecy as a product. They have trusts in America with that own these companies that are also very obscure. So.
Well, Obama did say that even though a lot of this is not illegal, it still needs to be tackled because there's an ethical question to it. So if there's an ethical question to should the whole world take Obama's advice?
I think the whole world should be against the idea of taxing your citizens when they're not living in your country, Michael.
I think America's the only one that does it.
there are one or two others probably, but it's a rather silly policy. It does tend to mess up the wheels of commerce as well. They take the same approach with their companies. They're trying to stop them doing so-called tax inversions at the moment. And all the companies want to do is to pay tax on their profits in the U.S., but not tax on their profits everywhere else in the U.S., to have to double tax profits they made overseas. So as a result, you've got companies like Apple with over $100 billion in offshore bank accounts, probably matched by onshore liabilities, because if they ever send their overseas profits back to the U.S., they'll be taxed again. So they ought to drop this witch hunt, basically, for Americans overseas.
But to be fair, what I pay in Hong Kong is deducted when I report.
Yeah, I know, basically their view is that you should pay your share of the U.S. defense budget and so on for protecting the world from Armageddon. It's a sort of umbrella philosophy rather than just taxing all the activity in the U.S. And the people working in the U.S.
Okay.
So that approach needs to be abandoned. If every country starts imposing the kind of obligations that the U.S. has imposed, the so-called FATCA tests, then we'll have chaos, because every small businessman in every country will have to fill in 200 forms saying whether or not he does business with Americans or British or Canadians or Australians and so on. You end up with all these multiple filings. They're trying to employ the banking system to catch their overseas taxes.
Interesting email from Peter. Thank you very much, Peter. He says, 2 points I would contribute to your show. This is relevant. First, interestingly, very few U.S. companies are named in the Panama Papers. It says 441. It looks more as the corporate media is also acting as a gatekeeper. The leak is being managed by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which is funded and organized entirely by the USA's Center for Public Integrity. Their funders include the Ford Foundation, Carnegie Endowment, Rockefeller Family Fund, W.K. Kellogg Foundation, Open Society Foundation, which is George Soros, among many others. I do not expect a genuine expose of Western capitalism. Clearly, this would imply editorial intervention by the funding sources due to a potential conflict of interest. The story would have been given more credibility if all the raw data would have been published via WikiLeaks or similar platforms, where they could have been accessible to everyone. Otherwise, it creates the impression that it is more a selective targeting. The real dirty secrets of Western figures and corporations most likely remain unpublished. Second, NPR's Planet Money did a very good investigative podcast in setting up a offshore company in a tax haven. They contacted lots of tax havens and finally decided to go through the process of setting up an offshore company. The show's final conclusion is the USA is the easiest and most secretive way to set up an offshore company. Is in the US. You don't need a passport copy for it. Those thoughts come from Peter. Thank you very much indeed for that, Peter. So Judith Clark, what are you saying about the International Consortium of Investigative Journalism seems to go against what you were
It does in a way, because, the new sort of funding, philanthropic funding, is obviously linked to major conservative foundations. And that was the first criticism that came out probably yesterday or the day before of the whole story. How are you going to get money to do this? Putting it out like WikiLeaks in a great massive data dump to the world. The WikiLeaks has got left behind now. It's a bit old. Nobody's really looking at it. At least it puts it in the hands of journalists. Journalists all over the place, right? We've seen, I can't remember how many media companies and 370 journalists. So there's a lot of people looking at it. And the funders are not only those people. If you look at the list on the websites of those two organizations, you'll find there's a great diversity of funders. It is an ethical problem.
Yeah, and they are going to publish the whole data set in the end.
So you don't buy this argument that the American media is deliberately covering up and protecting their own.
Well, the one reason given for this, the New York Times, which has been in on these things before, was not in on this one, and nobody has given a good reason for that, nor the Washington Post. There are only three outlets in the U.S., I think Miami Herald, a website called Fusion, and one more. So they were kept very deliberately low profile. And the big ones, obviously BBC and Guardian and Süddeutsche Zeitung, were in Europe.
Now, well, the Guardian has a U.S. edition as well, though, doesn't it?
Well, that's true. It was, I think it was done in Europe.
But does it really matter? Because these papers are globally available online. And papers anymore, they're websites.
That's true.
You can't really cover anything up, can you?
I think when the whole data set is published, there may be, individuals like me can start mining it and trying to find less celebrity names that may be of interest to investors in Hong Kong. So, to some extent, I expect the journalists looking at the sort of preview of this data have had to pick on people that they recognise with unmistakable names, because sometimes it's hard to tell which.
Of course, the Guardian went for Putin, and their story was a $2 billion trail leading to
a very
to
rich
Putin.
Cellist.
But they don't like Putin through a rich cellist and things like this. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at it through the political lens of the media organization.
Well, the NBC News yesterday, I watched it in the morning, they focus almost solely on Putin and didn't mention a single word about Xi Jinping.
Yes,
they didn't even mention the name Xi Jinping.
They're not a direct participant, so they're playing catch-up. Any newspaper or media organization that wasn't involved in the research has to suddenly write stories based on other people's stories, and so they take the Putin stuff from The Guardian and whoever else has looked at it. But over time, given such a huge trove of over 200,000 companies data, some of it will be completely boring and trivial, and nobody will want to write about it. And it'll have already involved companies which are known to be subsidiaries of Hong Kong listed companies. And so what? They happen to use Mossack Fonseca as their incorporation agent. But there will be more stories that people find in that data that couldn't immediately be found by a small number of journalists looking at it in advance. And I do think, the realities of the commercial world are, if you want funding for this sort of thing, there's got to be some privilege to the early publications to say, well, you've got 6 months to look at this before we release it, the whole set, to the whole world.
Yeah, I mean, Judith Clark, isn't this what, people, in some respects it just kind of confirms what people have always thought, or especially been feeling recently, that it's the 1% who set the rules who get richer, and it's the rich who get richer because they can manipulate things and they can evade tax, and the strictures that are laid down upon everyone else. And this is hence the support for Donald Trump, hence the support for Bernie Sanders and so on, hence the disillusionment with the establishment, with established politicians and the established, even the established media.
Yeah, it feeds into the polarization of politics, which is happening almost everywhere in the world, the Western world at least.
And they're right. And they're just going to say, yeah, this is more proof that it's the rich who are getting richer at our expense.
Yes, I think, as David said, it's putting pressure on not only the banks, but on people as well to protest about these things. You're talking about legality and ethical issues, but there's a fairness issue as well. And I think people are very unhappy with this, 1%, whatever it is, of rich people who are manipulating the money of the world.
Well, I think the media has been manipulating the people somewhat with this pursuit of the so-called 1%. If you want, as I often say, if you want equality, you can have it, but we're all going to be poor. If you want communism, if you want to have 100% taxes above a certain threshold, and as long as you can agree that globally so that some countries can't be more attractive to live in than others, then you can produce a communist world, but we'll have poverty.
So you support having a 1%, David?
I support having incentive and opportunity. And if that result of that is that some people rise from nothing to extreme wealth, so be it, because what they can't spend it all in their lifetimes. I mean, look at George Soros. It's no way he can spend it all personally, and he realized that very early on after he got beyond a certain level and started giving it away in pursuit of good causes, including ending communism and producing prosperity in Eastern Europe.
And supporting this investigative journalism.
And actually supporting this investigation, yeah. So, his money has been put to good use. The Bill and Melinda Gates
David
Foundation.
David Dogwell, what do you think? Should we have a 1% rich?
Bill Gates has spent tens of billions of dollars on trying to eradicate malaria and polio. Isn't that a good thing? If people are able to produce...
And Putin?
Not a good thing. Corruption,
David Dodwell, yes.
Honestly earned wealth, a good thing. Yeah.
Can I just do these comments about the investigative effort here? And it is encouraging to see the fruits of good investigative work, even if they were lucky to receive unsolicited material on this scale. The broader truth, however, as a journalist for a long time myself, is that the resources available for proper, thorough investigative work are being whittled away progressively around the world. The resources available are very limited nowadays, and this is in many respects an exception that proves a broader rule, that the journalist's ability to investigate rigorously are progressively more limited. I'm encouraged that this has occurred, and Edward Snowden, WikiLeaks, and these other examples of good, robust investigative work are very encouraging. But the broader trend is more worrisome. One other comment, I think, is that talking about the sort of geographical or biases of the findings so far discussed, I think that once the files do become fully available, we will learn a great deal more about China, which will be more interesting specifically to us. Even if the government in Beijing is currently blocking circulation of the reports about the Panama Papers, I'll lay you money that they're scrutinizing the data themselves extremely carefully, and they're going to be comparing the people that are on that list with the people that they've been investigating in the party elsewhere.
Absolutely.
And where the mismatches occur, then people like you and I are going to be able to say, well, why have you not been investigating blah, blah, blah?
Yes, it's not so much. Okay. It's not the bias. It's just that the data do expose corruption. There's more corruption in Russia and in China than there is in the US.
Okay. Well, the conversation will continue another time. Thank you very much indeed. A couple more comments. An email. Jim says the difficulty is that as a society we've become immune to corruption and its bed partner cronyism. Equality is impossible when an elite minority protect themselves by utilising their political and financial power to maximise loopholes in the legal system. Much of the unrest in Hong Kong is attributable to the obvious wealth disparity, says says Jim, and there's more comment on our Facebook page as well, which you can check out. Stephen, for example, says this is something that everyone knew was going on, but there was just no firm evidence up to now. Shouldn't really come as any surprise that people associated with the top leaders of the CCP, the crony capitalist party, are involved, because at the end of the day, they're just the same as all the other leaders around the world, says Stephen. Thank you very much indeed for those comments, and thank you to our guest this morning, to David Webb from website.com, David Dodwell, public policy consultant, and Judith Clark, Associate Professor at the Baptist University. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. 20 past 9, I wanted to